One, two, three. One, two, three. Thank you so much.
You're
okay,
welcome.
Great. So as I was saying, so I handed out a sheet last time, which is what Gilroy calls his manifesto. It's got about, I don't know, 15 to 18 statements, some of which you might agree with, some of which you might not agree with. We don't have time to read through all of them. I chose six for a very specific reason. And if you pull that sheet out, we're going to follow along.
Do you have more sheets for those who've had class?
No. I don't, sorry. I don't. So I'll just read these six statements for a very specific reason. I'd be curious to ask for people if you either affirm it, you agree with it, or you do not. And then I'm going to go back and tell you why I chose these six, okay? Because they will correlate to the definition of Zionism that I shared last week from the World Zionist Congress called the Jerusalem Program, which, when I interrupted myself, I said was passed in 1968, has been revised several times since, but more or less stays the same. It's more or less the main point, okay? So if you have the sheet, I'm starting with the first three, and I'm going to skip to the back page. So the first statement is, I'm a Zionist because I'm a Jew, and without recognizing Judaism's national component, I cannot explain its unique character. Judaism is a world religion bound to one homeland, shaping a people whose holy days revolve around the Israeli agricultural calendar, ritualize religious concepts, and relive historic events. Only in Israel can a Jew fully live in Jewish space and by Jewish time. So I'd be curious how many people would affirm that statement and agree with it. Raise your hands high and look around. It's not just for me, it's just for everyone. Okay. How many would disagree with that statement?
With sadness.
Okay, and how many have no opinion? Okay, so I'm not going to discuss it, okay? So just if you didn't look around, it was about a third agreed, about two-thirds disagreed, and then some number didn't agree. Okay, so that statement correlates with statement number four from the Jerusalem Program. I'm just going to read that because these are three statements of the same principle, okay? So statement four is, the aims of Zionism are, one of them was, the preservation of the identity of the Jewish people through the fostering of Jewish and Hebrew education and of Jewish spiritual and cultural values. The point of that first affirmation is the belief, which is controversial and always has been, that you can live more fully as a Jew in Israel than any other place in the world. Okay? That's a classic Zionist formulation. There's a lot of reasons to contest it, a lot of reasons to affirm it. I'm not trying to convince people either way, but I just want to correlate Troy's statement with the piece from the Jerusalem Program. Second statement on the sheet, think about whether you agree or not. I'm a Zionist because I share the past, present, and future of my people, the Jewish people. Our nerve endings are uniquely intertwined. We know we are never alone. When one of us suffers, we share the pain. When many of us advance communal ideals together, we and the world benefit. How many people would agree with that? Keep your hands up. Hands down. How many would disagree with that? So that was more like, 85, 87% for and 10% against, okay? No opinion on that one? Okay, so that essentially makes the statement that Jews are a transnational people that is centered in our ancestral homeland. That's the main point there. And that correlates with number one on the Jerusalem Program, which is about the aims of Zionism are the unity of the Jewish people and the centrality of Israel's Jewish life. Okay? So way more affirmation on that than on the first one. Third statement. I'm a Zionist because I know my history. And after being exiled from their homeland more than 1,900 years ago, the defenseless, wandering Jews endured repeated persecutions from both Christians and Muslims, centuries before this anti-Semitism culminated in the Holocaust. How many would agree with that? Okay, four. How many would disagree with that? Okay, even more overwhelming than last, more like 95% in favor. You know, a couple of people against. No opinion. Okay, so that would correlate. That's the idea that, and again, this is sometimes hard to hear, that Jewish survival requires that Jews are in a place where they can control their own destiny. So the experience of the Jewish people throughout history was that once Jews were exiled from the land of Israel in the year 70 of the Common Era, that was the second exile at the hands of the Romans, previously at the hands of the Babylonians. But since the year 70, which is how you count 1900 years, between 70 and 1948 is about 1900 years, Jews are always subject to some other power. So they survive or not at the whim of whoever is governing the land or their neighbors. Okay? So one of the principles of Zionism is to say, and this goes back to one of my last points last week about auto-emancipation. Remember I made that point? Anyone remember who wrote it, the book? Pamphlet? Very good, Leon Pinsker, okay? The notion is we can't rely on anyone else to liberate us. We need to liberate ourselves. And Zionism is a classic auto-emancipation movement, okay? And that correlates with this statement by Bill Troy, okay? That if we want to control our own destiny, we get our own land, okay? Now, that one correlates with number 5 in the Jerusalem program, which is simply the protection of Jewish rights everywhere. And I think I used the example last week of the notion, I think the best classic example is the raid on Entebbe, okay? Which I talked about in a book last week, the notion that Jews, not only Israelis, but Jews are held hostage in a foreign land, thousands of miles away from Israel, and the Israeli government felt a responsibility to rescue those Jews, whether they were citizens of the state or not. Okay, it's a very odd notion, but one that doesn't strike Jews as strange as it might strike other people who are not Jews. Okay? I want to skip to the back now and just give 2 others. Okay? At the top of the back page, if you're following along, says, I'm a Zionist because Israel worked, giving Jews a home after millennia of bruising homelessness, period. Israel welcomed Holocaust survivors and refugees from Arab lands, Ethiopians and Russians, those Jews who fled in fear of those who came by choice. I'm sorry, I read it wrong. Those Jews who fled in fear and those who came by choice. I'm sorry. And every day Israel navigates the many messes which inevitably resulted while delighting in the diversity, creating a modern moral society from an astonishing array of Jews, living democratically with Israeli Arabs too. It might have been easier to stop before the last phrase. Yeah, right. So let's lob off the last phrase for a lot of reasons, okay? Forget the last phrase. The first part of it is all about a principle that in Hebrew is called kibbutz galiot, a very important principle of Zionism, which means the ingathering of the exiles, okay? Kibbutz from the word kibbutz, but it literally means to bring together, and galiot, Jews from all over the world. How many people agree with that as one of the aims of Zionism? Who would agree with that as a principle? Okay, disagree? Okay, that's, again, about 95%, 98% in favor, a handful against, okay? That correlates with number 2 on the Jerusalem program. Almost verbatim, by the way, the ingathering of the Jewish people in its historic homeland, Eretz Israel, through Aliyah from all countries. One of the first principles of Zionism. 2 more, okay? I'm a Zionist because I celebrate Israel's existence. Like any thoughtful, self-critical patriot, though I might denounce particular government policies, I do not delegitimize the state itself. I'm a Zionist because I live in the real world of nation states. I see that Zionism is no more or less tribal than any other Western nationalism, be it American, British, Canadian, or Dutch. If bombing a Zionist makes us inherently racist, every citizen in a nation state is. In fact, we all express the eternal human need for some internal cohesion, some particularism, solidarity among some historic grouping of individuals and not others. Kind of a complicated thing, and I think there's a grammatical problem too.
Yeah, too many.
But how many people agree with that as a principle?
Some, but not all.
Yeah. Some, but not all. It's a compound thing, okay? And disagree with that? So that was a little bit more, even more like, but still about 80% in favor, a little bit more maybe, 20% against, okay? So we're going to talk more about this a little bit later tonight, okay? And it's the notion of, and this goes back to the stuff I talked about last week about emancipation and enlightenment, okay? The difference between individual rights and collective rights. This is a really important principle in the modern world, okay? Individual rights is one thing, okay? You can guarantee that, but deny collective rights. This statement says that Jews have a right to collective existence, not just individual rights wherever they're living, okay? And then it also makes the case about what is a really important concept in modern political science, something called ethno-nationalism, okay? Ethno-nationalism meaning that inherent in one's nationality is a particular ethnic identity, okay? America is fairly unique in the world in not having that. You know, you could say that what's the plan of our house right now? White supremacy, but also Christian supremacy, okay? That has emerged of late, okay? Is actually a form of trying to suggest that America should be an ethno-national state, okay? And many of us will say, well, that's un-American. Now, if you're in that camp, you say, no, we should be. And part of the what gives rise to Aryan supremacy or white nationalism or Christian nationalism is the fact that we're becoming more and more diverse as a nation, okay? More people of color, more people from all over the world, okay? More religions, more, all of which undermines a white Christian's notion about this country was given to us, right? So in this statement, the whole notion is that Jews have a right to collective existence, which, take America out of the picture for a moment, okay? The fact of the matter is there are many countries that are ethnic nationalist states. Okay? And you can make the case or the argument that Israel is one as well. Okay? That does not preclude the possibility of granting individual rights. Does not preclude the possibility of granting individual rights to non-Jews in a state. Okay? But the notion of the right to have collective existence is core to Zionism. And this, by the way, corresponds to number 4 on the Jerusalem program, which reads, the preservation of the identity of the Jewish people through the fostering of Jewish and Hebrew education and of Jewish spiritual and cultural values. Again, not exclusively, but primarily, okay? And by the way, in Israel, there is overwhelming agreement with the importance of having the Jewish character of the state. We're going to visit that idea a little bit later tonight as well. The last one I want to read is the following. I'm a Zionist because in Israel we have learned that a country without a vision is like a person without a soul. A Big Tent Zionism represents liberal nationalism at its best. Only by working together can we solve the biggest problems facing us, from hostile neighbors and environmental decline to poverty and bigotry. Constructive, open-minded, big-hearted nationalism dedicated to lifting us all up, not building more walls, can inculcate values, fight corruption, reaffirm national unity, and restore a sense of mission. How many people agree with that as a principle of Zionism? Okay, but raise your hand so I can see them and count them, more or less, okay? And disagree? Okay, that was, you know, closer to 60-40 on a vote, 60 in favor, 40 against. This corresponds to the principle on the Jerusalem program, which is number 3. The strengthening of the state of Israel, which is based on the prophetic vision of justice and peace. So even if the country falls short, it's aspirational, as all these statements are, okay? So it's just I'm going to stop there with the manifesto, but as we can see, even by taking these 6 statements, there are many ways to kind of like, to slice and dice this big idea of Zionism, and there are many elements to it, some of which we touched last week, and many of these things, if we wanted to, we could trace back to one or more of the ideological camps that I provided an overview of last week, okay? So, what I want to do now is talk a little bit about a few things in the Peter Beinart chapter, which I sent out. How many people had a chance to read the Beinart? Beautiful, great. So, what's fascinating about the Beinart is he starts out by quoting from Theodor Herzl's book called Alt Nuland, which is essentially German for the old new land. And understand, it's written in 1902. Okay? First Zionist Congress was 1897. So 5 years into the launch of the Zionist movement, he writes what essentially is a novel in which he is, if you will, fantasizing about what this old new land would look like. And people understand the old new, of course. So on one level, it's a new nation that's got to be forged in the 20th century. On the other hand, it's built on the remains or on the foundations of the land of Israel, which was created in the days of the Bible. Okay, that's the old new element of it. So in the book, the two most interesting protagonists are David Litwack and a Rabbi Geyer. And they're running in a presidential election to be the president of this new Altgula, okay? Think State of Israel, but it's, you know, not yet a State of Israel, okay? So Litwack is an educated individual who is Jewish, but he speaks Arabic, okay? And he's very committed to equal rights for all minorities, to freedom of speech and religion. Opposing him is Rabbi Geyer, not coincidentally a rabbi, okay? And for Herzl, again, from Europe, you say rabbi, it's an Orthodox rabbi. You've got to move out of your mind the American context that, oh, rabbi, well, what brand, okay? It's Europe, there's only one brand of rabbi, really, even though you've already had the emergence of Reformed Judaism, but it's not really in the conscience of most Jews, okay? It's a small phenomenon at this point in time. So the Rabbi Geyer in Alt Newland wants to strip non-Jews of the vote to make the state fully Jewish. Okay? Now, fast forward, you know, they talk about does art imitate life or does life imitate art, okay? This is more the latter in a sense, okay? Life came to imitate art because fast forward the 1980s, Meir Kahane is an Orthodox rabbi, grew up in the States, moves to Israel. In the States, he is the founder of the Jewish Defense League, which was founded as a precursor to, it's like kind of the, it was guardian angels before the guardian angels existed, okay? Essentially, Kahane said a lot of older Jews who were traditional / Orthodox were left back in the inner city, I'm using language from the 60s now, okay? As many of their kids were affluent enough to buy homes in the suburbs and they left mom and dad behind. And these elderly Jews were oftentimes mugged by people in the inner city. So Kahane says, we're gonna help Jews defend themselves. And he trains young Jews, and they actually had camps in the summertime, training young Jews to essentially protect and accompany elderly Jews going to the supermarket or back, okay? Then they got more extreme when the Soviet Union was started. There was a famous incident where they bombed the airfield offices in New York. It was bombed and there were some casualties. Then Kahane, on the heels of, you know, that rise to fame, moves to Israel, where he founds a political party called Kach. Okay? A Kach, the word for power, okay? And the symbol was a fist. And the first time Kahane ran for Knesset, he won a seat in the Knesset. But during that tenure, a court case came the Supreme Court, which essentially resulted in Kahane being ruled a racist, and he was disallowed from running for office again, okay? And that rule stood until very recently, okay? We're gonna have to change that as well. But the reason I raise Kahane is that Kahane's principle was the following. And what's great about extremists is that they make things very clear, they put things in binaries. He says, we have a choice. We can be a Jewish state or a democratic state. You can't have both, okay? And in my view, think Meir Kahane or think Rabbi Geyer in Herzl's Alt Newland, he says, we've waited almost 2,000 years to be a Jewish state. That's what we've got to do. And in order to do that, if you're not Jewish, you can't vote, okay? It may offend our liberal sensibilities sitting here in America, okay? But in the context of Jewish history and the founding of a new state, not bizarre, you know, not unheard of, and Kahane had a lot of followers, and his followers now are coming back very strong, and now control a large part of the new government, okay? So that's Geyer's platform. Now in the book, the ending is a happy ending. Litwack wins the election. From the guy who leaves the country, kind of in embarrassment and shame, right? Of course, there are a lot of things that Herzl doesn't anticipate, okay? Including some old thing called Arab nationalism, okay? One of the phrases, and I'm not exactly sure the source of who said this first, but it was very much around in the early years of the Zionist movement. It was a notion of, it's almost too simple to be, which is why it's memorable. A people without a land going to a land without a people. Right? That's how it was framed. Now, we know a lot now more about history, know how damaging that phrase was. But some of us in this room, maybe more than I imagine, were raised on that notion, okay? Certainly when I learned about Zionism, that was the principle, right? And it made perfect sense. The Jews had a land, they were banned from the land, they were persecuted for almost 2,000 years, it culminated from the Holocaust in a horrific way, and now, guess what? They're going back to an empty land, which has been waiting for them, you know, like a parking spot that hasn't been filled for 2,000 years. The parking spot's there for us. Let's just take that parking spot, because there's nobody there anyway. We know that's not true. But in a sense, Herzl's book is both prophetic in a sense and naive in a very tragic sense as well, okay? Because Herzl doesn't anticipate the rise of of Arab nationalism at all, which complicates the entire story. So this whole idea about can Israel be both Jewish and democratic is the issue, is kind of the biggest issue that Israel has confronted throughout its existence. Let's be aware of some things, okay? Is it an ethnic national state? All of the major symbols of Israel are Jewish, okay? The flag has the Jewish star. The words of the national anthem, I think, would talk about the desire of Jews to return to the land, okay? It's a Jewish song based on themes from Jewish history. Tzahal, Israel Defense Forces, okay, actually does not require Arabs to serve in the army. This is a huge issue, okay, for a country that has been essentially under assault from the day of its declaring its independence, okay? The notion of serving the army is kind of the ultimate notion of what it means to be a loyal citizen of the state of Israel, okay? So you could argue that, well, isn't it broad-minded or liberal-minded or kind of the leadership of the state of Israel to not require its non-Jewish citizens from serving the army? But the other side of the coin is that the coin of the realm, if I can use that expression, what gets you into anything you want to get into, a home, a job, a community, is where did you serve? When did you serve? Which is your unit, okay? And essentially, the units you serve in the IDF is not unlike, you know, the fraternity system, right? If you go to a university with a strong fraternity sorority system, okay? That network, oftentimes, you rely on for your future career, your job, whatever else. And the IDF is at least that, if not more than that, okay? So the notion, now Druze, who are not Jewish, do choose to serve in the army, okay? And there's been a lot of ideas raised in recent years about perhaps there should be some form of national service for all Israelis, Jews and non-Jews. So if you don't serve in the army, and the notion is, of course, if you serve in the army and you're an Arab, you might face another Arab on the other side of the battlefield. Which, by the way, Jews have experienced for a large part of the 19th to 20th century, where there were Jews on both sides of a war, okay? Not unheard of. Happened before, where you have minorities in different lands, okay? But the IDF is a strong kind of ticket into Israeli society. And finally,
the Arabs are not required to serve in the army, but some do. Some do serve, but there is no restriction to let them serve. If they volunteer, they can.
Do you even, I mean,
I knew somebody who was in my unit, who was an Arab, and he volunteered.
In my view, I've heard that, but it's got to be less than 1% of Arabs who choose to do that. I mean, do you know a number? I mean, I've never seen a number.
I don't know. can't force somebody to fight, you know, his own people, but the choice is there.
Yeah. Okay, so Gil's saying there's no law that prevents a non-Jew from serving the army, but other than the Druze, I'm not aware that it's...
Bedouin are doing a lot, and also, mm-hmm. I met some people.
Okay, so that's maybe the case, but again, it's very small, and for many Arabs, they feel that this is one more signpost of what creates a system that's discriminatory against Arabs. And the final piece about the ethnic pieces of Israeli citizenship or the apparatus of the state is the law of return, which many of you have heard about. The law of return essentially is a law that says that every Jew in the world is essentially an Israeli citizen in potentia. You simply have to claim it, and automatically you're a citizen. There's no need for a naturalization process, which would be the case in any other country in the world. If you move there, there's a process to become a citizen. Just like in America, you take a course and some time, and there are ways you become. And many people claim that that is yet another element of what could be seen as ethnic national or racist. It's just there. It's just a piece of the society. So, I want to mention a minority phenomenon that happened in Israel in the 20s, which is really interesting. How many people have heard of Brit Shalom? You know what that is? Okay, Brit Shalom was an organization that was founded by three individuals: Martin Buber, a name you should know, Jewish philosopher from Germany, who at this point has already moved to Israel. He escapes the Nazi Europe and he comes to Israel. Judah Magnus, who was the first president of Hebrew University, and Gershom Scholem, who was in the 20th century probably the most prominent scholar of Jewish mysticism in the world and a professor at Hebrew University. So these are three intellectuals, all in Jerusalem. You know, they probably, you know, went to the same cafe to drink coffee and hung out together. And they created something called Brit Shalom, which had that saw already in the 20s that the way Zionism was evolving was sowing the seeds of a problem in the future. Now, this is, of course, pre-state Palestine, it's the Yishuv, which is now still 25 years away from statehood, okay? But it's essentially that early that people see the blind spots of both Theodor Herzl and of the Zionist movement. And they claim that they've got to find a way to live peacefully, coexisting with Arabs who were there, because it was not a land without a people. Okay? And they were so clear-eyed about this that they said Jews should actually restrict immigration into Palestine, which, by the way, goes totally against the grain of where the majority of the Jewish world, and certainly the Zionist movement, was, because the Zionist movement saw, certainly by the 30s, that Europe was going to be a very dangerous place for Jews, and they were actually against the British mandatory government to allow more and more Jews to come in. Many Jews coming in illegally for years, okay? Something called those Aliyah Bet was the term for Jews who came in illegally because the British had very strict limits because they were trying to satisfy both the Arab citizens of the Yishuv and the Jewish citizens. So Brit Shalom people said, let's willingly restrict immigration, okay? Let's find a way to live peacefully, and let's stop the land purchases, which was going on in a very big way. This is money mostly coming from the diaspora, channeled mostly through the Jewish National Fund, in Israel called Keren Kayemet LeYisrael, okay, which is buying large tracts of land from absentee landowners, Arabs, mostly who were living in Lebanon, who were employing, so to speak, indentured Arab serfs, if you will, to till the land and create some income from that land, while the Arab landowners in Lebanon were making some big bucks. And when Keren Kayemet came in and said, we'll pay X dollars for this land, okay, it was a bonanza for the Arab owners because the land was pretty much worthless. You know, we're talking about subsistence farming. These were not, you don't think about the plush orange groves that give you Jaffa oranges, okay? We're talking about a land that was not well cultivated, not well taken care of, very primitive agricultural roots. And so that land purchasing is what actually acquired a lot of land for a quasi-governmental agency in the Yishuv called Keren Kayemet, which worked closely with the Jewish Agency, which was the other quasi-governmental entity which oversaw the development of the Yishuv. Okay? And Brit Shalom said, we got to slow down immigration because it agitates the Arabs who live here. And we got to stop the land purchasing because essentially it makes the Arab farmers destitute, because once the land is bought, it's not like the Jews want to employ the Arab laborers. They want to create Jewish settlements on that territory, which they did. Okay? So it's an interesting kind of like footnote in the history of the early pre-state of Israel. You should know that the reality is that two things put the kibosh on Brit Shalom and make it a footnote of history, but I want to mention it nonetheless. Number one, in 1929, riots break out in the Yishuv, and several hundred Jews are killed throughout the Yishuv. I don't want to use the word Israel, Yishuv. If you haven't heard the term, it's Y-I-S-H-U-V, the Hebrew word for the settlement. And that's what Israel was known as pre-state. So I'm going to use the word Yishuv. So hundreds of Jews are killed by Arabs who are incensed about more and more Jews are coming here. And so, you know, they had their comeuppance. And the other thing, of course, is a couple years later, the rise of Nazism. And those two things make the Brit Shalom platform seem naive in the extreme, okay? If Herzl was naive about thinking that there were no Arabs in the land, the Buber Magnus Shalom Brit Shalom operation was naive because they didn't anticipate history. Not that you ever can, okay? But it's just an interesting way of all the currents going on in the early state.
Did they change their mind, or change their platform? No. Or did they still remain?
To my knowledge, they did not. And I think, you know, a skeleton of the organization continued throughout that period of time. You know, and they said, we've got to ride out the tough times, okay? If you're committed to principle, we need to be committed to principle. So I want to move forward now and talk about two other things.
Can we go on? I didn't see it in the outline, but it might be a good point. Can you clarify for us our relationship to the World Zionist Organization? So like when we make our votes once in a while, we're encouraged, what say do we have to many of these ideas that you have here, or are we really just aligning ourselves with a political party and hope for the best that our feelings and sentiments will be respected?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the question was about how do we plug into the World Zionist Congress if it still exists? It does still exist, it still meets. I actually will tell you a quick story, because I was once a delegate to World Zionist Congress in 2001, in the middle of the Second Intifada, which was quite an experience. You may remember, by the way, when Idan was our shaliach here. Okay, we've had a series of four shlichim. Israelis have spent a couple years here and really gave us a tremendous insight into the state of Israel. Yadon actually had a table in the foyer for about 3 months during the time of the Zionist elections, where you could kind of read the literature, see who the various parties are, and you could cast a ballot for a party. The parties somewhat aligned with the political parties in Israel, but they're named different things, okay? Because it was a Green Party for a while, and the parties changed each election. It was back and forth. But there clearly was a Labor Zionist Party for a long time. Merkaz was the party that was sponsored by the conservative movement, conservative Judaism. Arzu was a party of the reform movement, so they put up slates as well. The JNF has its own kind of ticket, whatever else. And so a fair amount of money is spent to get people voting, because the more delegates you get in the World Zionist Congress, the more votes you get. So you could be represented. And by the way, in the Bible, you get counted in the census by paying a half shekel, okay? So no ticket, no washing. If you have a half shekel, you get counted. If you have a half shekel, you don't get counted, okay? And there was a similar thing in the World Zionist, there was like a token payment. It might have been $18. Anyone remember what it is? It's very, very modest. It doesn't even keep anyone out. It might be $18, it might be $10, very minimal. But not because they needed the money. I mean, yes, they needed the money, but it was more symbolic, because this is what I love about Israel. It may not always come through as in all the things I'm going to share with you, but the ability and the imagination to tie things in the modern world to things that happen in the Bible was brilliant, okay? And it touches me in a very deep way, okay? Like, whether it was $10 or $18 or $2, I don't really care, okay? The notion is like, you want to vote? Well, in the Bible, to vote, you have to pay your half shekel. So pay your half shekel, and you can vote in the Zionist elections. It's beautiful, okay? It's beautiful. Now, quick, I'm tempted to... It's a good story, but I don't have time for it, so what should I do?
Tell the story.
You might have to say 5 minutes later, okay. So I went as a delegate to essentially the Labor Zionist Party. Okay? It gets, by the way, the parties are the same as the Knesset. You get ranked by the Politburo or whoever runs it. You know? There's like a little committee that takes all the people, and you get recruited, you know, and they want to get, the bigger your name is, you know, the better it is, because people vote by how many names they know on the list. So if you get, like, Steven Spielberg and Barbara Streisand, you know, and Jerry Seinfeld on your list, you know, you can get them both. So, you know, I was not the first or second or third call, okay? I got called way down on the list, okay? But I said yes. I was intrigued by it, and I've been very, you know, had a strong... I've always identified as a Zionist. I thought it'd be really cool to do it, and I made the cut. We got enough votes that I became a delegate. So I went there as a delegate, and the wheeling and dealing was not to be believed. And it was so offensive to me, some of the wheeling and dealing, that with my day two, I decided I would no longer sit with my party because I felt like I would need a shower or something. Like I needed like a soul cleanse. It was like, really good. It was like just beyond my imagination. But I will say, I was impressed by many, many things, okay? First of all, Jews around the rest of the world, especially Europe and South Africa, take this up really seriously, okay? And they do their homework, and they're well-read, and they really know a lot. They kind of make a, I felt that the American delegations were kind of like, didn't even hold a candle to some of the delegates from other parts of the world in terms of the seriousness that they took, okay? But then there also was a point in the convention that got very ugly because there was actually a terrorist bombing while we were there, not more than a mile away. And I remember Sharon was going to come in to give a speech, and so half the convention wanted to boycott him, and the other part of the convention felt that he was like a hero, and you know, there was a fist fight that broke out in the back of the auditorium. He was just like, the kind of stuff you read in books, like just, I'm like, is this real? Pinch me, you know? All this stuff was going on. Anyway, it was an interesting experience. I'm glad I was there. But I didn't go away saying like, this is the most elevated deliberative body in the world. I didn't feel that way at all.
That's what political parliamentary democracy is about.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like the way we got a Speaker of the House last week, right? Yeah, a little bit like that, but it kind of makes that like child's play, what I saw. Okay, but nonetheless, it happens. But where I want to go, so that's my answer to that question. I want to go to my next thing, okay? Because I want to talk about two things that are really important here now. I want to talk about the UN Conference on Racism that happened in Durban, South Africa in 2001, okay? It's really, really important, okay? For a variety of reasons, and you'll see why in a moment, okay? Because essentially, what happened in Durban set the stage for the way Israel would be portrayed in the international community for the next 25 years. Well, not quite 25, 22 years, okay? And I found a great piece of reportage about the conference, I want to read to you to give you a little feel because I think this will take me shorter to read this than for me to kind of tell the story, okay? But I urge you to read more about it, but this will give you a sense about what happened in Durban. So, international conference to discuss racism, okay? And this was written on the 20th anniversary where there was another conference sponsored by the UN in Durban 20 years after the original conference in 2001. So this is from September 2021. okay, just a couple months ago. Some of the Jewish organizational officials flying into the city of Durban, South Africa, on the last week of August 2001 were excited. They believed the UN's anti-racism conference there would be an opportunity to exchange notes on a cause that the Jewish world had worked on for decades. Others, steeped in how the United Nations and its affiliates function, were wary of some of the players who were known for tirelessly steering every international conference to complaints about Israel. Still others who had been tracking preparations for the gathering knew that Iran, Israel's implacable enemy, was planning to take over the proceedings. But no one was prepared for what it became, a carnival of anti-Semitic expression that drove Jewish participants to tears every night and had been fearing for their physical safety. It was worse than I imagined, recalled Erwin Cutler, longtime Jewish human rights lawyer from Canada who'd go on to become Canada's justice minister. Durban was a festival of hate, said Cutler. As is conventional at UN forums, the governmental conference, which ran from September 2nd to 9th, was preceded by the non-governmental organization conference from August 27th to the 2nd, and that took place in Iran, and Jews were not invited. So the pre-conference, which set the stage and the agenda for Durban, happened in Iran, no Jews allowed. Okay, you're getting the scene now. Both events, the pre-conference and the conference, was overshadowed by the 9/11 terrorist attacks that happened a couple of days later. But the NGO conference, say the Jewish participants who attended, was a template for the next 20 years of anti-Israel rhetoric, codifying the argument, now increasingly prevalent on the left, that Israel is an apartheid state deserving of isolation in the world. It was also an eye-opener for many in terms of how criticism of Israel, however legitimate it might be, can be co-opted by an anti-Semitic agenda. I want to stop you for a second and just say this really clearly. There is a very big debate that goes on, especially on the Jewish left, okay, about how serious is anti-Semitism and whether anti-Semitism and whether anti-Zionism is the same as anti-Semitism. Okay? How many people followed the whole thing about the IHRA, the IRA, yeah, statement on anti-Semitism? So only a handful of you. International, what does it stand for? International Holocaust
Remembrance.
And what's the A for? Anyway, it took a couple of years to create, but essentially they came up with a definition of anti-Semitism, which is known as IHRA, I-H-R-A, and I got three out of four words right. So look it up, IHRA, okay? That's now being used pretty widely. However, Jews, liberal Jews, or liberal Zionists, do not like that definition of Zionism, of anti-Semitism, because in it, it essentially says that expressions of anti-Israel are tantamount to anti-Semitism. And Jews on the left have tried to make a distinction between criticizing the state of Israel, which many Jews on the left will do, including yours truly, I will do that, and people have heard me do that publicly in speech and in writing, okay? And to say that every person who criticizes the state of Israel is an anti-Semite. Now, if you're on the right, and I mean arguing center and right, okay, it is in your interest to say any anti-Israel statement is essentially anti-Semitic, because anti-Semitism, there seems to be kind of a overwhelming consensus that anti-Semitism is bad. Whereas whether it's, so if you can correlate a criticism of Israel and say that makes you an anti-Semite, it essentially gives Israel room to do whatever it wants to do, okay? So right now you have an alignment going on. And people know that the AIPAC for a very long time was the address for pro-Israel advocacy, okay? When I first came into the field, by which I mean I moved to Washington in 1984, I came here as the director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Washington, which is the umbrella public policy arm of the community. And there's a whole array of organizations that work in the Jewish, in the American public policy arena that advance the interests of the Jewish community. And I was in that network, okay? And every month, there was a meeting of all the executive directors of the organizations where different organizations led the conversation on different issues. So the American Jewish Congress, which has since disappeared, would lead the conversation on church-state separation, which was a principle of how Jews entered into public school here. The American Jewish Committee, which is still around, was always leading kind of the conversation on intergroup relations. Now we interact with Blacks, Hispanics, Latinos, whatever it's going to be, okay? And of course, on the Israel agenda, AIPAC ran the show. Like Israel would say, what's coming up for votes, where we stand on it, why yes, why no, who to lobby, whatever else, and there was no question about it. Now this is the mid-80s, okay? Things started to change a lot by the mid-90s, okay? Because AIPAC got outflanked first on the right by the Zionist Organization of America, that was more hawkish than AIPAC. And then with the emergence of J Street, they got outflanked on the left, okay? So it became very confusing on Capitol Hill. So who speaks for Israel on behalf of the Jewish community? It was no longer a very clear thing, okay? So that consensus broke down. Now, why do I mention that now? It's important to understand. If you are a pro-Israel advocate, okay, it is in your interest to portray every criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic, even if that is palpably false. Now, if there are other people in the room here who were, you know, center or center right, they would debate me on that issue. So I don't want to put it out there as an unquestioning correct statement. So you want to call it editorial, fine, okay? But I would argue that it's possible to criticize the state of Israel and not be an anti-Semite. Because if that were true, then I'd be an anti-Semite, okay?
As would many people in this room. Israel. You mean the government of Israel
policies
or
the
state?
Policies of the state of Israel.
The state of Israel.
Policies of the state of Israel. Policies of the state of Israel. You can't criticize a country, okay? You can delegitimize a country.
Okay, so it's the government of Israel that you are...
Right, criticizing policies of a country, okay? And I would say that the correct distinction between being a critic of Israel and someone who is either anti-Semitic or anti-Zionist, okay, is the argument of the latter group is to say there is no legitimacy to the entity called the State of Israel. That is an anti-Zionist position, and I would argue that the implications of that actually have serious ramifications for being anti-Semitic, okay? Now here too, people could argue with me on the left. If I had people to the left of me here, they would say they don't agree with that statement. So every statement I make here is debatable, okay? So all I can do is give you my perspective on it. The importance of Durbin is that it set the stage for the conversation that goes on now. I mean, and there's a million examples, I'll give you one or two. There was a conference a year or two ago in Chicago, an international conference on LGBTQ rights, okay? And what happened was, people know the word intersectionality?
Yeah.
Is that well known to people? So if you don't know, intersectionality is the word that says all issues are interrelated, okay? All issues are interrelated. So at this LGBTQ conference, a delegation came from Israel, which has a very, very active LGBT community and advocacy and a lot of things going on. So they came to the conference. But the leadership of the conference said, no Israel is allowed because you are an apartheid state. So essentially, the Israeli delegation was barred from coming into the conference, okay? Which, by the way, is essentially what also happened with the Women's March right after, what was the year the Women's March?
16.
It was 16, okay? So right after Trump's election, he had this, again, the Women's March?
2017,
January, right? Yes, okay, right after the election. So many people on the steering committee of the Women's March were themselves people who were proponents of this intersectionality argument, and many Jews who were trying to get involved in the planning conference were essentially kept out of the room. Okay? Then there was a reckoning that happened after the conference where they tried to kind of clean up their act. Okay? This is actually happened also with Black Lives Matter. You know, there are people in the Jewish community that say we should not cooperate with Black Lives Matter because if you read their 25-page platform, there's a thing there about colonialist apartheid Israel, okay? Is it the main platform of Black Lives Matter? No. Is it in there? Yes, okay? And so many people in the Jewish community say, like, we should not cooperate with them. It gets very, very sticky here in terms of you know, how you kind of parse these issues. And intersectionality has created a very confusing situation for Jews who care about Israel, care about other issues, would be critical of many policies of the state of Israel, but don't feel that we should be excluded from every forum talking about the environment, poverty, you know, whatever it is.
I shared with you
my
experience with the American Anthropological
Association. So, session.
It confused anti-Israel apartheid images with anti-Semitism, which Jewish students were experiencing on campuses. It was like...
Right. Yeah, so Al sent me after last week's class, he participated in the American Anthropological Society, and he found that before their national conference, they had a platform there criticizing Israel for being an apartheid state. What that has to do with the Anthropological Society's agenda? Nothing, okay? But this is now de rigueur. It's happening everywhere, okay? Anywhere you turn, you find this stuff happening, right? I mean, you probably, all of you are part of some group where you've seen this, you know, emerge.
Well, actually, I can also speak to that.
Martha, just stand up and
look at you. Well, I'm actually an anthropologist, and I was at the AAA. What they were trying to do was pass a BDS platform, a pro-BDS platform, and there was a very active response, which Aminu got involved with, to demonstrate how this was actually hurting the most liberal progressive wing of Israel, because BDS isn't just about economic boycotts, but it was also an academic boycott. But the other reason why I raised my hand originally was I believe the Black Lives Matter changed their platform, because about 2 years ago I was working on a paper and I did a search three times to find that plank, whatever you call it, in a platform. I couldn't find it. I'm not saying my search was infallible, but I couldn't find it.
Because one of the former leaders of the Inner Sanctum, one of the, I can't remember her name, but she was reported to be fairly close to Farrakhan. I mean, they had a real shakeup in leadership, so some of the early influence on the platform were no longer as strong moving forward. So that might be the reason.
Yeah. Look, the issue here is, I believe you're right, Martha. I think they did revise it. I would say that having been involved in Jewish advocacy and the professional Jewish community that tries to protect Jewish interests, there are many things to be admired, and there are many things that I find to be embarrassing and shameful. One of which is that it is a very unforgiving community. So you only have to make a mistake. I mean, this is way before we had the term cancel culture, okay? Mm-hmm. You make one wrong statement in speech or writing, and it's finished. Okay. You never will be redeemed, okay? You know, there are people who, 20 years after Jesse Jackson used the term Heimetown in a speech, okay? And Jesse Jackson, whatever you think of him, worked so hard to kind of build bridges to the Jewish community, but in many centers of the Jewish community, put an X on his name, okay? You know, once you make that statement, so you could say Jews kind of invented cancel culture, you know, and part, you know, you could say that it's partly a condition of our historical experience, okay? We have these hyper antenna out for potential anti-Semites, and so when somebody looks like they have an anti-Semitic bone in their body, and many people do, maybe this might, some would argue, you know, most non-Jews do for different reasons, okay? They are persona non grata, okay? And that's it, that in the rest of the world, it's very hard to understand, okay? Very hard to understand. I was in a, for about 7 years, I was in a Black Jewish clergy group that was doing pretty well until Louis Farrakhan called the Million Man March, okay? At which point, all pretensions of being polite and civil and understanding kind of fell by the wayside and became very ugly, okay? Because, of course, from the Jewish perspective, Farrakhan was not a Jesse Jackson. Farrakhan was like, he really earned the stripes of being an anti-Semite, and he was never repentant about it, ever, okay? He's still alive to this day. Whereas to black clergy, Farrakhan was a person who was promoting black pride, okay? And frankly, what his position were about Jews, they couldn't care less about, maybe they should have, but they felt that we rabbis representing the Jewish community, the Jewish world, the state of Israel, and God, you can add to that list too, okay? We're essentially tearing down one of their leaders, like you always do, they would say, okay? Either under their breath or out loud, okay? You know, when the second we have a leader, you find a way to tear him or her down, okay? And by finding one little thing they said 27 years ago, whatever, I think Farrakhan's offenses were far greater than that. But I'm giving you an example just to make the point here, okay? I want to move on because I know what's ahead and I want to get through some material. So what I want to do now is I want to talk about the two Israels, okay? I want to talk about Israel inside the Green Line and beyond the Green Line, okay? And I use the word, which in some settings would get me booted out of the room, the occupation, okay? Which, by the way, you know, even now, there are certain places, Jewish places, where if I said occupation, I would immediately be accused of being an anti-Zionist, an anti-Semite, okay? Because it's a word that puts Israel in a bad light. And by the way, that's not even the A word, meaning apartheid, which is now way out there also, okay? So language is really, really volatile here about how we talk about this stuff. But I want to make a distinction, and let me start with the following point. How many people know what Freedom House is? Okay, not enough of you. Okay, so Freedom House, you should look it up, okay? Freedom House is an organization, the headquarters are in Washington. Every year they do a ranking of every country in the world on a freedom index from 1 to 7, okay? 7 would be a country that would be the most, like Myanmar would be a 7, okay? A country that where there are no ranks, total dictatorship, authoritarian, persecution of minorities, add on to that, whatever else, okay?
China.
And, I'm sorry?
China and Russia.
Yeah, so you find others in a camp. And on the other hand, if you get a 1, that would be kind of the most open, free society. And the rating is very helpful, and by the way, it's very hard to get into that business and not be criticized. Freedom House, in many ways, is above reproach. I mean, people recognize that rating in a very responsible way. By the way, more so than the annual State Department Human Rights Report, okay? Because Freedom House is an international NGO, okay? Without national alliances, the State Department is part of the U.S. government, okay? So there are parts of the world that say, U.S. government, there's an agenda there, and oftentimes there is, okay? So here's what's interesting. In terms of the debate, which you may sometimes be part of, you may sometimes precipitate, or be sometimes sucked into, is Israel a racist state? Is it an apartheid state? Is it a democratic state? These debates are going on now, and it's hard to avoid them, okay? If you're smart, which I'm trying to argue you should be, and the fact that you're in the class means you're on the road to being smart and already there, okay? You need to just stop and say, like, which Israel are we talking about? Okay? Because they're two Israels. And in fact, in Freedom House, which I think speaks to the integrity of the report, there are two ratings for Israel. There's one rating for Israel inside the Green Line, and there's another rating for Israel in the territories, the occupied territories, over the Green Line. That's really important, okay? And on the Israel proper inside the Green Line, and I'm not saying that's going to be the eventual borders, but that's what the Green Line essentially is, the borders pre- the Six-Day War, when Israel expanded its territory by 35% or so, okay? So in general, inside the Green Line, Israel usually gets rated at 2 or 3, depending on the year, okay? Whereas the occupied territory usually gets rated, you know, a 5 or 6, okay? It's two different Israels, okay? And there are many examples that justify that, that back it up. Okay, so I first want to talk about Israel inside the Green Line. And in a second, we're going to go to the PowerPoint. I've definitely been waiting patiently to put the PowerPoint up. So in, let's bring up the first slide, okay, if we can, Debbie?
Sure.
Okay. So how many of you have ever heard of the Orr Commission? Okay, just a couple of you, okay. So this is important. In 2002, every so often throughout this history of the state of Israel, the let's just put out a fact. non-Arabs in Israel, who many of them now want to be called Palestinians, by the way, which gets confusing. And I'll go back and forth with the terms. By the way, there are Arabs in Israel who do not want to be called Palestinians. The younger they are, the more likely they do want to be called Palestinians. And it represents their desire to identify with their national movement. Now, if this analogy offends, I apologize in advance, but think Jews in the 20s, okay? If you were a Jew, even if you were planning to move to the Yishuv, okay? And you were sympathetic with what the Zionist movement was doing to try and get Jews into a place where they can create their own society, okay? You would identify as a Zionist. Essentially, an Arab who lives in Israel, who wants to be called a Palestinian, is akin to that Jew, saying, I identify with the national liberation movement of the Palestinian people, okay? So, that just explains the nomenclature about Arabs and Palestinians, but in terms of the numbers, about 20% of Israeli citizens are Arabs slash Palestinians, okay? You need to know that. And based on the Israeli constitution, which doesn't exist, but at least the Declaration of Independence anyway, okay? It says that there will be freedom of speech, freedom of rights, freedom for voting, freedom of assembly, whatever, for all people regardless of race, religion, or nationality, okay? So on paper, de jure, the Arab Palestinians of Israel have equal rights. De facto, it's a two-tiered system in Israel, okay? Every so often, even though the Palestinians of Israel have a higher living standard, a higher educational standard than their counterparts in Arab countries surrounding Israel. Notwithstanding that, within the country, they understand that they're second-class citizens, not unlike the situation of blacks in America. That's maybe an imperfect analogy, but I think it's a pretty darn good one, okay? In other words, it's a perpetual underclass, and we've created a system, an economic system in America that assures that people of color will always be a second-class citizen in this country, even though de jure, in law, they're supposed to be equal, okay? So, you know, talk about the whole voter suppression thing, which is going on now, but some form of voter suppression, you know, that's one of the more mild ways of keeping blacks out of the body politic, okay? But you go to the extremes of lynching as well, okay? And everything in between voter suppression and lynching, America has come up with many clever ways to keep people of color as a professional underclass in our country, which, by the way, serves the economic interests of white people. Okay? I don't want to get too far into that, but that's out there. So when the anger of Palestinians in Israel bubbles up, there are events, strikes, riots, terrorist action, whatever else. So one situation in 2000, there was uprisings, and 13 Palestinians were shot. Okay, think Kent State. Okay, essentially it's a march, and Israeli police, they weren't, it wasn't an IDF, I don't think, opened fire, and 13 Israeli Palestinians were shot. The result of which created a big hubbub throughout the world, and Israel, by the way, because Israel was also scandalized by the event. They appointed a commission to look into it, headed by Theodore Orr, okay, who was a member of the Supreme Court of Israel. Okay, and this is what came out of the panel of inquiry. Okay, just go back one thing, because is there anything? Go back one. 12 citizens and one Palestinian were killed, okay, by police. Right. So here are the findings. If you can't read it, I'll just read it. Government handling of the Arab sector has been primarily neglectful and discriminatory. This is now an analysis not just what caused the riot, but it became a major statement about how Israel has treated its Palestinian minority since the founding of the state. That's why it's so important as a document and as a commission, okay? Neglectful and discriminatory. The establishment, meaning the state of Israel, did not show sufficient sensitivity to the needs of the Arab population and did not take enough action in order to allocate state resources in an equal manner. That's A. B. Serious distress prevails in the Arab sector in various areas. Evidence of the distress included poverty, unemployment, a shortage of land, serious problems in the education system, and substantially defective infrastructure. All still true, by the way. Although, by the way, something that came out of the Orr Commission that was really important. I'll say about that, maybe I'll just take now. On the heels of the Oral Commission, many things happened to improve the standing of Arabs in Israeli society, okay? Including appointing many Arabs to very high posts in different parts of the Israeli government. I'll give some other examples later on. So it's not as if there was no movement as a result of this, okay? Now, C actually talks about the other side of this is part of what created the agitation. In various mosques, messages were transmitted delegitimizing the state of Israel and its security forces, and serious hostility and antagonism towards the symbols were expressed. Various circles raised demands to grant autonomy in some areas to the Arab minority and to abolish the definition of the state as a Jewish state, instead making it a state for all the citizens. Okay? This has been an ongoing debate in the country. Okay? Is Israel the Jewish state, or is it a state for all the citizens? Two different implications of those two statements. Okay? This blurred more than once the line between the Palestinians of Judea and Samaria and Arab citizens of the state. So what it's saying is the reason why Israeli authorities and the Israeli state were threatened by its own citizens is because of the increasing rhetoric and the argumentation line of Arabs was closer and closer to what could be heard in Arabs either over the Green Line or in Arab nations surrounding the state of Israel. So that's not excusing, let's go back up before I get to that, that's not excusing what happened. It's simply trying to, part of the commission's report, to say, how do we get to this state of affairs, and want to identify that phenomenon. By the way, even today, there are different Arab political parties that span the spectrum in terms of cooperation. You had the Ram Party, which was the first party that actually got a minister in the last government before the present one, Mansour Abbas, was the first time an Arab became a member of the cabinet. It was quite remarkable. And by the way, and this is kind of remarkable, when Amnesty International came out with a major report this past year declaring Israel an apartheid state, yes, that did happen, look it up, okay, Mansour Abbas was interviewed by Israeli TV, and he said, and he didn't even take my class, he said, what Israel are we talking about? He says, Israel within the Green Line is absolutely not an apartheid state. If you want to talk about practices over the Green Line, that's another matter. So you had Mansour Abbas, an Arab, who essentially says, no, Israel's not apartheid as a state, but its practices in the territories where there's a military occupation could be called worse than apartheid, okay? It's essentially a gigantic prison in many ways for the Arabs who live there, okay? So that's kind of a background on this. So before we go to the maps, I want to just share a few things in terms of attitudes, both good and bad, okay? This is the good news and the bad news. In terms of attitudes towards Israeli Arabs or Palestinians, I'm saying them synonymous, okay? Citizens of the state of Israel who are Arabs or Palestinians. 70% of Israelis, this is from data from the Israel Democracy Institute, which is a NGO in Israel, okay? They do a lot of good work and a lot of good polling. So 70% of Israeli Jews oppose having Arabs in the cabinet. 56% of Jewish high school students would deny Arabs the right to run for any Knesset seats. 56%. 44% of Israeli Jews believe that Jews should not rent apartments to Arabs. Another example is there were like five elections before the one that brought in the Lapid government, okay? The Lapid-Bennett government, rather. And Bibi Netanyahu, who's now again the prime minister, after one term out, had a technique that every time as we approach the election, he would talk about the danger of Arabs voting, so you better get to the polls and vote for the good guys, okay? Which is, you know, a classic othering of people who are citizens of the state who have a right to vote. And he's claiming that their voting was essentially an unpatriotic act, or at least unpatriotic because they weren't going to vote for him, okay? And that, by the way, worked time and time again, okay? You get Israeli Jews worked up about the fifth column of Arabs in Israel, and that's going to get them out to the polls to vote for the governments that will kind of like tighten the reins a little bit to keep the Arabs where they belong, putting that in air quotes, Okay? It's just a phenomenon that's gone on for a long time. And by the way, fast forward from the tragedy in 2000, the killing of the 13 Israeli Arabs, okay? In May 21, you had another, even more horrific outbreak of violence throughout the country, where essentially Arabs and Jews were in serious clashes, one with the other, okay? I'll tell you a quick story. Sandy and I were with our daughter Jenny in Israel. I'm very close to really one of the leading Israeli Arabs. I'm blanking on his name right now. Mohammed Darbashi, thank you. Mohammed Darbashi, who's now at Divach Aviva. Full disclosure, I serve on their board, okay? We had Mohammed Darbashi speak here at Dar Shalom, I remember some years ago, okay? So I've done a lot of stuff with Mohammed. He's just a brilliant advocate for Israel, very loyal Israeli. We went to visit him soon after those May 21 riots, and he told the story that he was trying to drive into, I think, Afula, to a hospital, to visit a friend, and they literally were, there were Jews on the highway pulling Arabs out of their cars and beating them up, okay? And when he got to this blockade, essentially, of Israeli settlers, okay, they asked him, you know, Arab or Jew? And he said, Jew. And Muhammad's Hebrew is good enough that he could speak Hebrew without an Arabic accent, okay? And he said that saved his life, okay? But just hearing someone who I'm very close to, having had that experience of being this far from being pulled out of the car and being beaten and or killed, which happened also, okay, was worth it. That's what happened throughout the country in May 21. So right below the surface are tensions between the two communities. So if that's the bad news, let me give you some good news, okay? One of my... Yeah, Gil? Real loud. Just stand up and real loud.
Obviously, I'm not justifying their behavior and all.
Yeah.
But in this year, there was also the clashes. Arabs in Israeli the cities like Haifa, like Akko, like Lod, who were lynching Jews.
Totally.
So this was the right extremists doing the opposite.
Yeah, it was both sides. It was vigilantism on both sides. That's totally true. Okay. So one of the things I've been quite involved in for the past several years, it goes back about 10 years, I helped form something called the Greater Washington Forum on Israeli-Arab Issues, which actually was the first local chapter of something that started at the JDC in New York, where several major national organizations, Jewish organizations, including the ADL, American Jewish Committee, a lot of mainstream Jewish groups, were all part of a coalition to raise the consciousness of Jews around the world about the importance of Israeli Arab citizens and the need to make sure that they have equal treatment in the state of Israel. So I got involved with that project and we created this whole thing in Washington, did annual major programs, some of you have been to them. It was under their auspices that we brought Mohammed Darwashi here several times. The reason I mention it is because it has created some changes in Israel, okay? I'll give you just a few examples. In November 22, the Knesset passed the second five-year economic development plan for the Arab sector worth $10 billion, not shekels, which was twice the size of the plan that was passed in 5 years earlier, okay? There is a tremendous amount of economic activity happening in the Arab sector. Now, here again, in politics, there are no friends in politics, there are only interests, okay? And I believe that to be true. One of the reasons that drove this is not because Israel suddenly started to love the Arabs. They felt that if Israel was going to become a first-tier economic power, they needed to stimulate the economy in the Arab sector. Now, this is really interesting. The two drags on the Israeli economy are the Haredim, who essentially don't work and just go to yeshiva, okay, and the Arab sector. And when folks, including on the far right and the far left, took a look at Israeli society and said, where will we have a better chance of success? It was not a tough call, okay? Forget the Haredim, we're never gonna change there. But if we start to create some economic stimulus going on in Arab sectors, in Arab villages, we can create some things happening. And it's been tremendously successful. There's now, Ezra Arif was a senior minister, economic minister, and there's just tons of activity in the tech sector and every sector where industry is being created in formerly Arab villages, which used to be quite economically depressed. Some other examples of things you, if you don't know about, should know about. There is something called the hand-to-hand schools in Israel. There are six of them, which does not touch a lot of population, but is symbolically very important. These schools have equal numbers of Arab and Jewish students. Every classroom has a Jewish and an Arab teacher, and there are co-principals, one Jew and one Arab, okay? We have visited the school in Jerusalem, quite remarkable, and the way they treat some of the hot button issues is very inspiring, okay? Because they both teach about Yom HaZchut, Israel Independence Day, and the Nakba Day. Nakba being the other side of Yom HaZchut, because Nakba in Arabic means the disaster, which is the way Arabs think about Israelis' Day of Independence, the day that they lost the country to the Jews, okay? And learning how to do that is really kind of interesting. Another example, Givat Aviv, which is where Mahan Darashi works, has a national program which touches far more Israeli children than the hand-to-hand schools. They've created a program which has touched tens of thousands of kids, where they essentially find teachers from the other sector to teach language. So for example, they'll put Arab teachers in Jewish schools to teach Arabic, and they'll put Jewish teachers in Arab schools to teach Hebrew, okay? In most, every situation, these are the only non-Jew, non-Arab person they've ever met who they can see in a human way, okay? So there's some attempts that really are making a difference in terms of how Israel's trying to accommodate, but it's still a two-tier country. So that's inside the Green Line. Now I want to show you a bunch of maps to talk about the occupation, which many would argue is probably the single biggest issue. It usually gets raised when we talk about the two-state solution, okay? Everyone's heard about the two-state solution. JC was founded on trying to advance the two-state solution. A series of U.S. administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have voiced support for a two-state solution. The bad news, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, is that two-state solution is virtually impossible at this point in time, and these maps will tell you why, okay? So in some way, it's in Israel, they've done polling about two-state solutions, and I think it's now under 20% of people even believe in it, because they know it's not possible, because they live on the ground, okay? Whereas American Jews still are like 80% in favor of the two-state solution, which is kind of like saying, you know, like, I wish I could fly, you know? It's like, it would be nice, but it's not gonna happen, okay? But these maps tell the story. By the way, that statement that I made about the two-state solution being virtually impossible today could not have been said 20 years ago. It was definitely possible 20 years ago. It might have even been possible 10 years ago, but the maps will tell you why it's pretty much not possible now. So, by the way, just full disclosure, these maps, the best maps I found, come from Al Jazeera, okay? Now, I want to explain that. I said earlier how much language counts. Some of the language on the maps is a little bit provocative. They may offend some people in the room. But the source of the data comes from the Israel Bureau of Census, okay? So the numbers are solid and correct, even though the narrative is what Al Jazeera put it, because their audience are Arabs, and that's what they wanted, that's what they read, okay? Which, by the way, matters, okay? The kind of things you read affects behavior and attitudes, okay? So just know where it comes from. So this shows the green is the area over the green line, okay? So the blue is the map of Israel before the Six-Day War, okay? So look at some of the numbers. And there's one really fascinating number here in terms of where Jews live, where Palestinians live. But if you add up all the Palestinians in Israel, in the West Bank, and in the Gaza Strip, they come out to almost the same number as Jews in the same territories, 6.8 million, which is pretty fascinating, equal number. Now, they're not distributed equally, okay? You'll see in some later maps where the pockets are, okay, which matters a whole heck of a lot. But interesting, you know, in terms of the demographics tell a lot of stories here, okay? Let's go to the next slide. So, again, Palestinian, the headline is Palestinians Expelled, okay? This is a fairly recent stuff. There's a class of historians in Israel called the New Historians. Interestingly enough, Betty Morris, who is a well-known historian, began as kind of like the most prominent of the New Historians, who talked about, exploded the myth that some of us were raised on, that in 1948, the Arabs left what became the State of Israel because the Arab nation said, clear out, get out of our way, we're going to destroy these, you know, bothersome Jews, and then you can go back to your homes. That's what a lot of us learned growing up, okay? I nod your head if you learned that growing up, okay? Yeah, so more than a few of you, okay? So Betty Morris and other historians in that New Historian School came out with what they found was a plan I think it was called Plan B. Whose architect was Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, which actually shows that there was a plan to essentially create as much of a Jewish majority within what they thought was going to be the border of Israel as possible, which included both gentle and not so gentle expulsion of hundreds of thousands of residents of that area. Okay, if you want to call them Palestinians, here again, which code becomes problematic, Arabs, Palestinians, whatever else. So the number here that's being used, this number has actually now been backed up by the Israeli Bureau of Census. The number is somewhere between 700,000 to 800,000 Arabs who were removed during the War of Independence, okay? Not because Cairo said leave and then you can come back, but because the Israeli military forces were following orders to essentially try and create an Arab-free Israel. You then see further movements of the territories from 48 to 67, 95, and 2020. The 2020, by the way, is Trump's map from the Trump peace plan, which led to the Abraham Accords. Mixed story there. I'm not going to go too deeply into it. Okay. But there'll be another map that'll talk about the Oslo Accords and areas A, B, and C and the territories. I want to get to that. Okay. Let's go to the next map. So this shows you where Palestinians live in Israel. So these are Arab Palestinians who live in Israel. Essentially, the red dots are Palestinian villages, okay? And the green are where you have strong clusters of Arab settlement, okay? Next map. So Jerusalem was conquered, liberated. Language matters, okay? Jews do language. In the Six-Day War, Israel had been a divided city, West Jerusalem and East Jerusalem. In the Six-Day War, Israel went into East Jerusalem. They were able to get to the Kotel al-Maravi, the Western Wall. There's that famous picture of four soldiers standing, looking up at the wall, which is kind of iconic. And in Israeli history, it's seen as a tremendous, like, high watermark in terms of Israeli history. Here again, a lot of historical work has been done around this. That did happen, okay, for sure. And now Jerusalem became a unified city. In 1980, Israel annexed East Jerusalem. This is important. The difference between conquering a territory and annexing it. So Israel conquered the West Bank over the Green Line, has never annexed the territory. But they did annex East Jerusalem, which was Israel's way of saying, this is not going back. Okay, from the Arab point of view, you know, going back to the Oslo Accords, this is a major sticking point because many folks and diplomats feel that Jerusalem has got to be among the things that are on the table in any negotiation. The Israelis were saying that's not going to be negotiated. And that's, and by the way, it also affects the voting rates. This is really interesting. It's very hard to get a number, and I've looked for a long time. Arab voting in Israel is lower than Jewish voting, okay, but still pretty high, you know, on American standards. Depending on the election, between 50 to 70% of Arabs vote. However, East Jerusalem, there's been a kind of a collective agreement since 1980 for Arabs not to vote, even though they're allowed to vote, as a way to say, we protest the annexation, we do not want to vote in Israeli elections, because essentially that confers legitimacy on the state of Israel, and Arabs and East Jerusalem don't want to be part of that. Judy? Well, we'll get to the areas A, B, and C. You'll see. We're not there yet. So, you haven't missed anything yet.
So the green, I wasn't sure what the green.
No, the green. If you go back, that's inside the green lines. So that doesn't matter. Okay, that's simply where you have Arab villages or concentration of clusters of Arab villages within the green line.
So I meant like those first few maps that were the Al Jazeera maps. I don't know what I was supposed to learn from that.
Simply how the borders of Israel have changed since 1948. That's the reason I showed that map. Just wait a second. Let's just go to the next map, please. Okay, so this is what's important. This goes to your question, Judy, okay, about areas A, B, and C. So as part of the Oslo Accords, they divided up the West Bank into three areas. A, B, C. A are areas that are under full Palestinian control. So you have something called the Palestinian Authority.
Is it possible to focus?
To what?
To focus.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Good. I think it is better. Thanks. Yes. So there is something called the Palestinian Authority, which in some ways succeeded the PLO. Okay, the PLO was the liberation army or terrorist group, depending on the language you want to use. Okay, but once you had the agreement between Arafat and Rabin signed on the White House lawn in September of 90s. I forget, doesn't really matter, okay? But as of that point, you had a Palestinian Authority that was recognized by the State of Israel, and Mahmoud Abbas is the president of the Palestinian Authority, fairly unpopular with Palestinians. Many Palestinians see him as essentially too close to the Israelis. Part of why that happened is that in order to get control of the West Bank or these areas, there had to be some security arrangements where Israel could trust the armed security forces of the PA to put a limit on Arab terrorist activity. Okay, so there's clearly cooperation between the PA and the Israeli government and the IDF. That definitely happens. In many parts of the Palestinian community, that's a big no-no. Okay. When Abbas dies or steps down, whichever comes first, okay, not clear, it's almost inevitable that the new head of the PA will be more anti-Israel than Abbas. In the same way that when Ariel Sharon allowed Gaza to have free elections, I put free in quotes, okay, Hamas won the election, Sharon thought the PA would win the election, okay? So if you allow the Arab street to vote, they would want their leaders to be in the rejectionist camp. Again, this is some lingo. Some of you know it, some of you don't. Rejection being you reject the legitimacy of the state of Israel, period. Okay? So the areas that Palestine, that PA controls, includes Hebron, Bethlehem, Jericho, Ramallah, whatever else. Area B, which is 22%, is joint Israeli-Palestinian control. Palestinians would say that's essentially Israeli control. There's no such thing as joint. And area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, is Israeli control. Now, to the point that Judy asked, why is the two-state solution impossible? The fact of the matter is, throughout this area, I think it might be, go to the next slide and we'll come back to this if we need to. I think the next slide. Yes. So you see here, essentially, what are Israeli settlements, okay? The green are legal settlements based on the state of Israel. The red are illegal based on Israel. Israel calls them illegal until now, by the way, because the new government has promised to turn all the illegal settlements into legal settlements, okay? That's one of the many positions that Bibi essentially conceded to create a government, because Ben-Gvir and his cronies say there's no such thing as illegal settlements, we deserve all this, okay? And if they had their druthers, they would banish all the Arabs from this part of the territory, not unlike what happened in 1948, okay? So there's no way you can create a contiguous territory for a freestanding, independent state of Palestine anymore. It's just not possible. Area C is, I think, about 65%. 60%. 60%.
Is that Israel, the green line, Area C?
No. The green line is something different. The green line is everything. That's the earlier maps. The first map showed the green line was the borders of the State of Israel before the Six-Day War. Okay?
So what is Area C?
All three of these are maps of the West Bank. Okay? It just shows who's got control, who runs the show in different parts of the West Bank.
So Area C is Israel control?
Total Israel control. Area A is total Palestinian Authority control. Area B is joint control. Yeah.
Just one question I had was about population base. I mean, you could say Area C is 60%, but I would imagine that the population, I mean, the major population centers are under PA control.
Correct.
And that's probably, so if we're looking at how much of the Palestinian Arab population is under Israeli, lives under Israeli control, I would think that that would be, and I recognize we have the issues with checkpoints, whatever.
Right.
But I would think it would be relatively small, and we may not have the exact number.
Yeah, that would be an interesting number. So Debbie's just raising the fact that since the PA controls the urban centers, they may have a significant number of Arabs under their authority as compared to real estate. There's a difference between population versus real estate. Okay?
So, can I ask a question? This is about vocabulary.
Just
about vocabulary. When I lived in Israel in the early 80s, is I think when people started talking about Judea and Samaria, I noticed in the War Commission report that they used Judea and Samaria.
Right.
In the early 80s, that was seen as overtly political to make it seem like that was part of Israel and it should be accepted as part of Israel. Now it seems like, based on at least the War Commission report, that that's just how it's referred to. I mean, by Israelis, by Supreme Court justice in Israel refers to it that way, and that's an interesting change, and I just wondered if that's correct.
Yeah. So it's true that the Israeli right, both the religious right, the political right, like to talk about Judea Samaria or the greater land of Israel, which was to say the borders of 1948 were just an accident of history. That's not meant to be the original borders, and they're basing their claims based on the Bible, okay? I think that in the Oslo Accords, part of the concession to Palestinians was to come up with neutral terms for the territory because it would be essentially provocative to call Judea Samaria, okay? But just to fast forward once again, the position of the new government of the State of Israel is that there's no such thing as illegal settlements. This should all be Israel anyway, and it probably should be all Jewish, meaning Arab-free. And that's the direction this government is headed in, okay? I think that, is there another one? I think that, these are the illegal settlements. This is the last slide. It just shows population growth. You know, one of the things that has fueled the settlement movement is that not only is it ideologically driven, that's a piece of it, but in some way, I mean, a lot of us are kind of the same age. You know, our kids are hoping to buy their first home, right? And so what it costs to buy a home and what real estate costs matters a whole lot. So Israel's population grows. The urban centers are very expensive. It's almost impossible to buy there. The land in the territories over the Green Line has been made very cheap, to which the Israeli government has provided massive subsidies to get Jews to settle there. So you have not only have Jews who are settling there because of ideological reasons, saying this land is our land, and I'm not about to sing the Pete Seeger song, okay? But those are the same words, right? But then you have other people who are not ideologically driven at all, simply like, I've got a choice between getting the same size apartment in Tel Aviv that's going to cost me, you know, $1.5 million, and if I go to someplace in the territories, it's going to cost me $300,000. Okay, that's a no-brainer. Okay, so it has fueled a lot of the growth, and it shows the growth of the population in the West Bank is the top line, whereas the growth of the population in Israel proper has been pretty much the same. Yeah, please. No.
So, what you just said about the government kind of incentivizing settling in the West Bank, right, and over the Great Line, I mean, so this whole idea of there's two Israels, but who's responsible for what's over the Great Line? There's really only one Israel, right? So it reminds me of saying, like we have a really horrific for a developed nation maternal mortality rate in the United States. But which United States are you in? Are you in California or are you in Texas? They're all part of the United States, right? So it's still part of Israel, and the policies that are incentivizing some of the behaviors in the West Bank are still part of the Israel that's not over. So that's, I mean, is that right? Like, who's responsible for the second Israel if it's really distinct from the first Israel?
Yeah. So look, based on international law, okay, occupations are supposed to be temporary, okay? And large parts of the international community deems Israel's control of the West Bank illegal. Sharon, when he gave Gaza back to the Palestinians, was trying to kind of defuse what he read as becoming an increasingly hostile atmosphere in the international community that would redound to the negative consequences for the state of Israel. So first he was going to try and unload Gaza, and had he lived and had that worked out better than it did, he might have tried to unload the West Bank. But nobody following him wanted to follow that guideline, because what happened was the giving the Palestinians Gaza backfired, because it got taken over by a more hostile and antagonistic political force, arguably a terrorist organization, Hamas, as opposed to the Palestinians, which were, in some people's view, moderate, you could talk to them, whatever else, okay? So that's kind of how it rolls. By the way, you know, like, who's, one of the things so crazy, sometimes you get into arguments where they say, like, who's a terrorist and who's a freedom fighter? So some folks will say, well, guess what? If you look at some of the people like Menachem Begin, pre-48, he would have been considered a terrorist by the British, okay? You know, all the folks who were agitated to get the British out, there was terrorist activity going on, okay? And if you win, you become a founding father or a freedom fighter, right? If you lose, you go to jail and you get killed, you know, or hanged. And that's kind of the game we play. Right now, just talk about, you know, it's well known that Marwan Barghouti, who's been in jail for more than 20 years for having blood on his hands for some major terrorist activity, that the Israelis are in conversation with him about succeeding Mahmoud Abbas. It's crazy, okay? By crazy, you might read that the wrong way. Meaning that it's crazy, maybe it's smart. In other words, that Israel knows that if there's ever gonna be peace, they need to have someone in that prime minister's seat who's got more street cred than Mahmoud Abbas. Barghouti, and this is, it's not even black humor, it's like bizarre, it's obscene, it's offensive, but I'm going to say it anyway, okay? Marwan Barghouti gained his political credentials by killing enough Israelis to be legitimate in the eyes of a lot of Palestinians. And that might get him, might make him the president of the PA in a matter of years. It's crazy, okay? But fast forward 50 years, it might well be that Barghouti becomes the president of the PA, and it works out well. Who knows? Like, the whole thing is so crazy. There's just there's so many ironies going on here, left and right, okay?
What's the trend in population of Arabs, or Muslims, whatever country you want to find versus Israelis?
Okay, so it's a really important question. Bobby asked, what's the trend of population? So let's go back to the apartheid conversation, okay? In 1968, Meron Benvisti, who was the vice mayor of Jerusalem, heads up a commission, essentially saying, what is the consequence of the fact that Israel has taken over all this territory? And in 68, Benvenisti predicts everything that's happened since, okay? He says, we need to get out of here really fast. He says, within 3 to 5 years, we gotta be out of the territory, because what's gonna happen is one of two things. Either, if it's all gonna be annexed and become part of Israel, and we continue to be a democracy, we will have Arabs voting in Arab government, and Jews will be a minority in their own state, okay? That's not acceptable, he would say. The alternative is to create an apartheid regime, and then this uses a term, where you deny the vote to anyone who's Arab, in which case Israel becomes the next South Africa. It's predicted in 1968, and that's where we're at right now.
He influenced Sharon. The whole Gaza decision is what I was reading back then.
I had never read that, but it's quite possible. Quite possible. I mean, it's been so, that harsh reality has been, anyone who knows this, the region knows that that's the impossible conundrum that can't be resolved. So no government of Israel has been prepared to do either annexing the entire, and that's why East Jerusalem was annexed, but the West Bank was not annexed, because Israel doesn't want to face that too head on, but we're there right now, okay? By population, if you create one entity called Israel-Palestine, which includes the territories, even excluding Gaza, okay? The fact of the matter is, you saw the population numbers. It's 50-50 right now. You count all the Jews and all the Palestinians. It's 50-50 right now. In 5 years, it'll be, 55-45, and continue in the wrong direction, because Israeli birth rate is, probably 2 to 3, and Palestinian birth rate is probably, 4 to 5 per household.
That's what happened in Lebanon between the Christians and the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And they just decided no longer to count them. So it was a 50-50%, but everybody knew that the Muslim percentage was much higher than 50%.
Yeah.
It's even higher now because many of the Lebanese Christians have moved to Dearborn, Michigan.
Okay, we'll just take a couple. We're well way past time. We'll take 2 or 3 questions and then we'll call it a night, okay? Susan, and then.
You just haven't mentioned Sinai.
Okay.
If you can put Sinai into the mix, which did go back to Egypt.
Yeah, but it's a very low, poorly populated area. There are not a lot of people there. I mean, this is back to the real estate people ratio, okay? It was significant from a map, from the map perspective, but not in terms of numbers with that much. But by the way, some people will remember the newsreel of moving people out of
No.
What was the city that was blown up in Sinai? I forget now. But
No.
I'm forgetting now. It doesn't matter. But there were these horrific scenes where you have Israeli military forcibly removing Jews from a city that was built in the middle of the desert, because essentially Israel agreed to kind of like give the Sinai back to Egypt, right? So multiply that 100 times over if you're gonna try and create something in the West Bank where it is now heavily populated by both legal settlements, illegal settlements, and Palestinians. Sue?
Yeah, this is
stand up and reel that, please. So there are like a dozen, bombs like this, which yeah. I'm not going to get to, but I want to speak to it because you asked the question. So one of the things in negotiations during the Oslo talks and other peace talks has been what's called the right of return, okay? Which is a principle that essentially the Arabs put on the table, the Palestinians put on the table, saying that there are now several million Palestinians all over the world who should have the same right of return that Jews say Jews have the right of return based on the law of return, okay? Israel knows that that's a demographic time bomb. They're never going to say yes to that, okay? And the counter to it coming from the Israeli side is to say, how about this? If you're willing to get every Arab nation to provide restitution to every Jewish family who was banished from those countries and put that money on the table, then we'll start talking about the right of return of Palestinians. So if these are all non-starters.
You misunderstood my question.
Okay. Yeah, it is complicated, and I mean, having just been in Morocco, you know, where there are Jews who say, you know, we also have some Arab, you know, identity as well, it's too complicated to address here. Yeah. Wow, there are a lot of questions. Shelley, I'm looking at the hand that hasn't spoken yet.
Next time,
Shelley,
could you address the anti-Zionist ultra-Orthodox sector and their influence on the politics of Israel right now, because I don't understand the anti-Zionist piece of that. I mean,
yeah, I'm anti-Zionist is part of next week's topic. Remind me to talk about the Orthodox part of it, because I was going to talk more about the left anti-Zionism, but I think we need to throw the Orthodoxy, the Haredim into this as well. So remind me of that. Anthony.
So is your basic message of the evening that the situation is very complicated? Serious. It doesn't lend itself to the sort of rhetoric or, you know, either demonizing or idealizing the situation.
Yeah, you just reminded me, you know, the Jewish Book Council has this thing where every year they have a dog and pony show where if you're a brand new author, you're brought to an event at some JCC somewhere in the country, and all the people who run the Jewish Book Festival at JCCs come there, and you're given 2 minutes to summarize your book, which you've spent a decade working on, okay? So Anthony, you just did that quite well. You just summarized the entire evening in less than 2 minutes, so thank you very much. It is complicated. Neil.
Betty Martin, stand up, please.
Betty Morris was
here before the virus came, and he was a visiting professor at Georgetown for a year or two. And you're absolutely right, the first part that he got hell for it because he blew up the myth.
Right.
On that part. But, and he revised his book when it came out to discuss the second part. And I think it was more nuanced than that the Jews really the one kicked out the Arabs. In his second book, it's like Deri Yassin, where he goes into a lot of detail on that. And I read that several times. I'm still trying to figure out what really happened.
Yeah, so I appreciate you saying it because I actually didn't finish the point I wanted to make about Betty Morris. Really important. So Betty Morris, who actually was the leader of the New Historian School, you know, like leading intellectual, did a 180, okay? Betty Morris now is a hawk. So despite all of his reading, his newer stuff is all about why Israel deserves to control the whole thing. So, you know, people change over time, and Betty Morris, no one has changed more than Betty Morris. He's now on the other side of the aisle, totally. Yeah. Debbie, last question.
So maybe just something to think about for next time. The one thing that I don't think we addressed, but is something that historically has sort of bothered me or made me wonder, is what is the role of unprovoked war in obtaining the land that we occupy, and how does that relate to international law regarding the spoils of war and what is considered fair and ethical? So I just think it's really important as we talk about all these issues of Six-State War or Yom Kippur or the War of Independence, that we have to recognize what preceded it and what the actual security considerations were and why, you know, these are real threats as well as, you know, people being power hungry and, you know, exploiting populist ideas. But it's a big...
Yeah, I'll just... We're not going to go there next week at all, so I'll give it 1 minute right now.
Okay.
Look, international law also needs to be put in air quotes, okay? Because even though international law says that territory that's occupied during a war is not does not belong to the occupier, okay? There are There are dozens of examples where that is not imposed. E.g., Russia, Crimea. Like, nobody said to Russia before the invasion of Ukraine, like, by the way, Crimea can't be yours, Russia. Just because you had the force to take it over, okay, doesn't mean it's yours, okay? And yet, in Israel, it's been forever an issue that Israel is illegally occupying this territory. But there are so many examples of countries that have captured territory that take it over, annex it, and then it's done. It's all finished. And nobody talks about it. You can't find an article anywhere written about it, okay? So it's more than double standards going on this, which doesn't justify Israel's handling of the territories. It's just to say, and that's why I wonder about the Durban thing. I mean, Durban was probably the most obscene example of double standards in a world that includes Myanmar and China and Iran and the Congo, and go on and on about places which in Freedom House would give you a 7, the worst possible rating, okay? The obsession with Israel at Durban is like the paramount or paradigmatic example of a racist country, you know, simply drifts with irony and tragedy.
Thank you.
We'll end there. Thank you, everyone. Next week we'll finish up.
Government no longer prints a map with a green line.
Who does?
The government in Israel, even before they did not. In Tel Aviv, they wanted in the schools to have a map with a green line.
Yeah.
But the school education is run by the government, not the city.
Yeah.
And so the government said you can't have that map up there because...
Which is like critical race theory. You know, can't teach critical race theory, right?
Just vanish
history, right?
Tel Aviv put it up anyway.
I found it. I think if you haven't seen this, you're going to want to look at this.
Okay.
I was looking up Peter Beinart. This came out yesterday in Jewish Currents. It's a fascinating article. I only read half of it before coming here.
Huh?
What he talks about, so you see the title.
Yeah.
I mean, he's talking about and using, he starts out with the anecdote of Zionist Organization of America awarded Trump its highest medal, and then 9 days later. But what's really interesting about this is he's looking at polling data by Pew and Gallup in Europe. And so, for example, the Eastern European countries that are most favorable, like Poland, Romania, towards Israel, I mean, which he conflates that, I guess, with political Zionism.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Can you give me an email if you can send that to me?
Yes. Hold on one sec.
Good. Don't go away. Good.
You
can, right?
Yeah. Right. You got it. Yeah. You know, I mean... Anyway, he's talking about an inverse relationship between anti-Zionism and...